Are you working? What kind of work do you do?
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Summer of 2018 is boom time in America. But of course, it's a different America. The robots are here. Just one in 12 American workers is making stuff in manufacturing, compared to one in three in the 1950s. One in 50 of us works in agriculture. The miracle, the mystery really, is that more of us than ever are still on a job and working harder than ever. Buried in the numbers is the question how we're feeling about the new work and what it's doing to us. David Graeber has the argument that we're putting to our own street corner test this hour. Graeber is the rogue anthropologist, a people watcher with a PhD, the exiled American professor at the London School of Economics. His funny and disquieting new book is titled Bullshit Jobs. He has titles and categories for them, like flunkies, box tickers, and taskmasters over work that won't be done but needs to be supervised. The Graeber argument is roughly that the boom in bullshit jobs, creativity coordinators, corporate lawyers, telemarketers, assistants to people who don't need assistance, all the lubrication of late capitalism, is driving us crazy. On sidewalks, in offices around Boston for the last several weeks, we've been asking people to drop a dime on a BS job.
Are you working?
I think I have the ultimate BS job. I'm working at a winery right now, and I don't know anything about wine.
I worked in a pet supply store once. Stinky, smelly, sludgy, gross kind of job, and also a BS manager. That's probably my worst experience ever.
I was an assistant at Bank of America in advertising, and they used to fight over the color red, how deep the red should be, how bright it should be.
I was a pool guard once before, not a lifeguard. I just guarded the pool so that non-tenants didn't get in.
Sold security systems over the phone to people who thought they were going to win a John Deere lawnmower.
Oh my God, Swiffer, moving around their logos and changing colors and stuff. And we had to change the colors to fall colors because that was the Swiffer du jour. It was absurd.
I temped once, and the temp agency told me that I was going to be helping a nonprofit with its fundraising, and I was counting cash for a televangelist.
I once had a job calling for a carpet cleaning company to do backup calls to see if they wanted to get their carpets cleaned again, but it turned out that the company was just stealing record players and expensive equipment from everyone's houses, so I would get on the phone and people would start screaming at me and I would hang up again.
I had to ask people questions after they bought their donuts about their experience at Krispy Kreme.
Have I ever had a bullshit job? I mean, I was in the United States Army.
What does it mean about us, David Graeber, that something under half, more than a third, of all of us think our jobs are useless?
Well, I assume that if people think that, they know what they're talking about, because who would know better than the person doing the job? What it says about us as a society is very interesting. It shows that we place such an enormous value on work that it doesn't even really matter to us to check whether jobs actually do anything. We just kind of assume that it's better to be working than not to be working, no matter whether your job does anything or not.
Who launched the idea that work as an end is good? Better to be working than reading a great book or dancing.
Yeah, it's not just Puritanism. Usually people say, well, it's a puritanical idea, but it goes much deeper. It goes to the idea that people who aren't busy all the time can get themselves in trouble. I remember my mother said her grandmother would always say, idle fingers knit sweaters for the devil.
Yeah, the devil makes work for idle hands or something.
There you go. There's always sayings like that. And I guess the idea is that anything a teenage Jewish girl in, you know, Poland in whatever, 1850, might be doing when not knitting things was probably going to get someone in trouble. So there's an idea that work is good because anything else you might be doing is probably bad. But the idea that work itself is good, that it's better to be working, especially working under somebody else's power, that in itself is good. Well, if you look at history, there was an assumption that was true if you're very young. there's an assumption that kids should be working for their parents. And actually, in Northern Europe, for the Middle Ages, early modern Europe, you know, for most of that time, anybody who was an adolescent, who was a young man or a young woman in their 20s, was assumed you'd be working for someone. But that was just a temporary thing. That was a way to learn your trade, and that was a way to learn proper self-discipline. Then you become an independent person. You become an independent operator. You get married, you start a household, and maybe you employ other people, other kids, because you're a grown-up. It's as if once we develop a system where everybody's working for somebody else, we never get to be grown-ups. We're stuck in this permanent adolescence where we're constantly sort of sacrificing our free time to learn discipline to become these people that we're never actually going to be, you know?
David, what's the truth of the Freudian line? I've heard it all my life, that love and work are the basic foundations of human happiness.
I mean, it depends on what you mean by work. I think he meant having an effect on the world, to transform the world in a positive way. That's a key to what makes us human. I found this very interesting psychological theory. It goes back to the 19th century, a German child psychologist named Groos. That guy discovered something really interesting. He said that infants, you can catch the moment where they become aware they're different from the world around them when they realize they can have predictable effects. You know, if a child is moving their arms around and they knock a pencil down across a table, well, they're curious, right? But if they move their arm again and realize it will have the same effect, that they can move the pencil again, they become incredibly happy. The sudden realization that they can, like, wow, I can do things and it will have predictable effects. This is so cool. And there's this sort of sense of joy, because that's the moment, he says, when you realize that you're not the world, you're something different. You can have effects on the world. And I think that this never leaves us for the rest of our lives. You know, what we are is creatures that can change the world. And if we lose that, we're miserable.
Because work and jobs are not exactly the same thing, or they're not the same thing by a long shot.
No.
Go back to jobs.
Yeah.
What you call BS jobs.
I came up with that term especially to convey the sense people have that they're kind of living a lie. But they're living a lie not of their own making. And this is what makes it so frustrating. Mm. You know, if you can scam somebody into paying you to do nothing, maybe you're happy. Maybe you're not. But if you find yourself in a job where, in fact, you didn't even think that's what you were getting into. You thought you were getting into a real job, but they never assign you any responsibilities, or you realize that you can do them in 2 hours a week and you have to just shut up and pretend you're working the rest of the time. Or you actually are working, but you realize the entire enterprise is stupid and pointless and doesn't actually do anything, or what it does do is something that you feel is socially useless, which is a very, very widespread phenomenon. It's a terrible feeling because you're kind of forced to become a fraud and a parasite against your will. Mm. That's the BS element. You know, you're supposed to pretend that you're working and you're not. Anybody has a real job, you know, if you're like a dishwasher and there's no dishes to wash. The most annoying part of that job is they'll always give you something else. Clean the baseboards. I don't care if they've already been cleaned. Do this. Pretend to mop the floor. I don't care if it's clean. You're always supposed to be working. So pretending to work when there's nothing to do is always the thing that makes you really angry. That's the worst part of any real job. But these are like entire jobs like that, where all you're doing is pretending to be working.
I'm picturing Dilbert in his cubicle. How many kinds of BS jobs are there?
The funny thing is, there seems to be an almost kaleidoscopic variety. I asked people to tell me, what was your most pointless job? Have you ever had a job that just was completely useless? If it didn't exist, it would make no difference whatsoever. I got hundreds of replies to this. And one of the fascinating things was how different they all were. Well, some of them were jobs like telemarketer. Well, you're doing something, but people felt if this entire industry didn't exist, the world would be a better place. Another example of that kind of thing were corporate lawyers. A lot of people in PR and in advertising would say, you know, I just think this entire industry is pointless. But, you know, many of these jobs were just actually literally doing nothing. You know, they would have jobs where essentially they were filling a chair. There would be jobs where you'd have a company with twice as many managers as employees, and the managers just sat around managing each other, basically.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Sit around minding other people's business.
In British academia, we call this the creating committees to discuss the problem of too many committees problem.
Mm.
Some of these jobs just feed on themselves. Some of them are just pointless managerial, administrative, or clerical work, like brand managers, vision coordinators, vice presidents for creativity, this kind of thing. Consultants. A lot of people in HR feel they're in pointless jobs. A lot of people in middle management. A lot of people who have jobs like political lobbyists and PR consultants, but also a lot of people who are just in kind of pointless time-filling data entry where you don't really need a person. This could be very easily automated, or menial BS jobs, which are actually the most frustrating of all. Assistance to people who don't need assistance but just feel they should have an assistant because it makes them look important, or because other people of the same status all have assistants, so I need to have one too. That sort of thing.
David, we need a guide through the whole bestiary, a typology of these things. Where are these BS jobs?
Well, for obvious reasons, they're concentrated a lot more in rich countries than poor ones. But, you know, I had people writing to me from Brazil, India. There's versions of it in Estonian, Vietnamese, Persian. So the problem is not limited to rich countries. Neither is it limited to either the private or the public sector. It seems to be about equally in both. In a way, it seems more common in the private sector. For example, the increase in the number of administrative assistants and administrative staff in universities, which has been astronomical. It's gone up at like 3 times the rate as professors or students, 5 times the rate. The private universities are much worse than the public ones because there's some kind of oversight in the public universities. But the private ones, really the only people paying attention are the trustees, and they just assume that, of course, if you are an important manager, you should have lots of assistants. You know?
Is there any such thing as a BS job in agriculture, say? Is there any such thing as a BS job that's truly physical labor?
There are BS jobs that are blue collar. There are people who wrote to me and said, I was a fire watcher, but they put me in a place where I wouldn't have actually seen if there was a fire. They just wanted to say they had a fire watcher.
Interesting.
I was there to count the number of trees that were being preserved here, even though everybody knew they didn't need that. There are people who guard empty rooms in museums. So those are blue-collar jobs, but the overwhelming majority are office work.
Our guest, David Graeber, taught anthropology at Yale and served a term as godfather to the Occupy Wall Street campaign in 2011. His first book was called Debt, A Giant History. His new one is called Bullshit Jobs, A Theory. Coming up, the central conundrum at work, it's the suffering in it that makes your job valuable. This is Open Source.
I'm a fool to do your dirty work.
Our guest, David Graeber, is not the only authority on BS jobs. A colleague of ours in public radio, Louis Cronin, a.k.a. Cronin the Barbarian, says that writing gags for Tom and Ray at Car Talk was not her first BS work experience.
I worked in a pickle factory as a pickle packer, which meant I packed kosher dill spears and made sure that the seeds faced out. I had a job in a Polish neighborhood, alphabetizing checks at a bank. So it was like, does Szyznowski come before Szyznowski? I worked as a waitress in England at a Wimpy's, which was a burger chain. Such a bad restaurant that I one night delivered a chicken dinner to one customer and a fish dinner to the other customer, and I had mixed up their orders, and neither of them had complained. I worked as a house cleaner for drug dealers, and my job was to vacuum pot seeds off the couches and get rid of the lines of coke on every mirrored surface. Let's see, I also worked dusting at a construction site, which was basically one of the most useless jobs I've ever done. Worked at a camp and had to teach 4 to 6 year old girls how to pee in the woods and was totally unsuccessful. They all emerged with wet pants.
Louis Cronin makes her own work now, writing novels. Her first one was Everyone Loves You Back. David, the basic finding here is that we all have a very, very ironic, winking, insecure relationship with this word job and what we do and whether we'll get another one and what it's worth.
Well, I mean, it's so hard to get a job that pays the rent at all. And that's the thing. You know, you can get a useful job, right? That's not that hard. But the thing is, it won't pay very much. You know, if you become a preschool teacher, for example, or you become a nurse, that takes some training, or you can get jobs driving a bus, you know, that's a useful job. The problem is that jobs like that don't treat you very well. They don't give you very good benefits and they don't pay you very much.
An important point right there. You make a considerable point of the inverse relationship between the real value of a job and the pay that it gets. As you're saying, preschool teachers compared to executive assistants.
It's not much talked about. But if you say it, people say, you know, that's really true, isn't it? It's one of these sort of open secrets about our society. The more your work actually benefits other human beings, the more obvious the social benefits your work provides, the less you're likely to get paid. And in fact, the less dignity you have in your labor, the more you tend to be abused at work, the less benefits you get. It's an inverse proportion in what society will reward you for doing the job and the actual social benefit that the work provides. It's quite remarkable. And there are economists who've confirmed this. There are a few exceptions. You know, doctors get paid well. But even amongst doctors, the doctors who are paid the best are plastic surgeons. In fact, someone told me that the doctor who's paid the most in all the world is actually a specialist in anal bleaching. So yes, doctors who actually, you know, save lives are paid considerably less than ones who do things that are basically kind of vanity or useless. People who actually have a negative impact on society, some people have estimated that the average advertising executive or financier probably subtracts $5 of social value for every dollar they make, whereas, you know, a hospital cleaner, it's exactly the opposite. They add $9 for every dollar they're paid. Now, most of us linger somewhere in the middle, and the BS jobs are, you know, roughly at zero. They change the world in no way at all. But they're paid fairly well in comparison to jobs that actually obviously help people. And one of the strange things is there's this disconnect between the way people feel about their own jobs, right? You know, if it's happening to you, you know, it's like, wait a minute, I'm doing necessary work. I'm taking care of disabled people. I'm cleaning buildings that if they weren't clean, it would be dangerous. You know, I'm driving people around in a bus. That's, if they didn't have that, they couldn't get around. It's obviously useful to people. Why is it that I'm treated so badly? Why is it these other people are paid so much more? You know, so people are indignant when it happens to them. And other people who are just paid lots of money to do nothing are actually indignant too. They're quite miserable in many cases. So when it happens to you, you know, people realize there's a problem here. But on a larger social level, and this is what really fascinated me, people justify it. They say, well, you know, these people took jobs like that because they want to help others. They can help others by not taking so much money, you know. They're teachers. They're the ones who are teaching our children. We wouldn't want greedy people to be teaching our children. So there's this assumption that, you know, if you're out there to do good in the world, you shouldn't be overly rewarded.
We asked listeners to call with job stories, and they did.
When I was a student over 50 years ago, I only lasted a week on a donut assembly line in a large bakery. My job, in the days before complete mechanization, was to grab 6 donuts from an assembly line as they rolled by, lift them, swivel to a second assembly line, and on this line came boxes in which I neatly deposited the donuts. I then swiveled back to the first line, grabbed more donuts, and repeated the process. I did this for an 8-hour shift with just a couple of breaks. Worst of all, of course, was the fact that I could not get to sleep until I started up those assembly lines in my dreams.
For a summer, I worked in a factory where I had to get on a forklift, a scissor lift, with a clipboard and a calculator and count boxes 8 hours a day, driving around and around and around a giant warehouse, and then make sure that the counted boxes match the number on the sheet. And if the number changed, I changed the number.
I'm just calling to say that I'm an employer. We have employed a lot of high school kids and college kids over the years, and now most of them act as though working in a hardware store is a bullshit job, and I don't think anything could be further from the truth.
The great Eminence Lloyd Kane said a long time ago that by this time we'd have 15-hour work weeks. There's a suspicion that work is overrated. What happened?
It's a really interesting question, right? Because if you look at the kind of jobs that actually existed back in the 1930s, when Keynes was writing, well, he was right. Most of those jobs no longer exist. They have been automated away. Almost all the farming jobs are gone. A lot of the industrial jobs are gone. They start talking about dark factories, factories of nobody actually working there a lot of the time. They just run automatically. So, you know, there's this whole rhetoric about, oh, no, the robots are going to take our jobs. What are we going to do? To a large extent, that's already happened. But the amazing thing is we're all working just as much. In fact, by some measures, we're working actually more than we were in Keynes's time.
So, what sustains that? A, why do we work so hard, all of us? And you know, B, why do we keep thinking up jobs that don't really need to be done?
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, if you ask people in the abstract, well, why aren't we living lives of leisure? Why aren't we working, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day if we could be? People say, oh, well, I guess we had that option, but we went for consumerism instead. You know, given the choice between less hours and more stuff, we went for more stuff. But that would make sense if we were all working, you know, in factories making iPhones or serving each other designer sushi all day. But that's not actually what we're doing. The increase in jobs is not in services. In fact, if you look at actual services, you know, giving people haircuts, serving people coffee, that sort of thing, the number of people employed in that has remained pretty much constant at 20% of the workforce for about 100 years. This whole idea of the rise of a service economy is largely a red herring. What has changed is administrative, clerical, supervisory, and managerial work. And that's just exploded. Mm. And that's the area where people feel that they're in BS jobs, where a lot of people are saying, well, I'm not actually doing anything all day. So it's as if we created these dummy managerial jobs, these dummy clerical jobs, to replace the fact that, you know, we no longer have to be working in factories or, you know, farming all day. They're completely unnecessary.
We seem to have created those jobs to distract us from the leisure and the abundance that is out there waiting for us.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. If you look at what people were talking about in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a very, very self-conscious kind of panic in a lot of elite circles around exactly this problem. You know, people like the hippies or in France's situationists were actually saying, yes, let machines do all the work. Soon we won't have to work anymore. So there was a kind of a anti-work movement, the sort of mass bohemianism of hippies and yippies and so forth. And at the same time, the people in the ruling class were forming these think tanks saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? Technology is advancing too quickly. Soon the entire proletariat is going to turn into hippies. It's going to be a disaster. People were talking about this. This is like 1971 or 72 Future Shock came out, but it was the fruit of long conversations saying, you know, all of the social problems of the 60s are really due to too rapid technological change, too much automation. You know, the jobless future is upon us. It's going to be a disaster. There'll be rebellion. People will be, like, forming these radical groups because they all have nothing better to do. All forms of authority from patriarchy to class hierarchies are going to fall apart. And we must do something about this. And it's very interesting because around that time, you get this phenomenon of technological stagnation where a lot of the technological advance that people just assumed was normal for much of the 20th century starts slowing down because they reallocate the resources. But even aside from that, there's this idea that we need to, like, make sure everyone is working. And we need to make sure that work is no longer so secure. So they start casualizing work.
A couple of other great authorities that you quote, David. Orwell said that the perpetuation of useless work is driven mainly by fear of the mob.
I think Orwell was correctly divining an attitude on the part of the wealthy and powerful that a lot of wealthy and powerful people really were very explicit about in the 60s and 70s. They actually said that. They said, you know, the problem is people have it too good. People assume a life of abundance. They assume that we're going to be working less and less. They assume that machines are going to replace the jobs. And they're all going to be on the streets becoming radicals, and it's going to be a threat to public order, you know? So in that sense, I think Orwell was vindicated.
David, you quote C. Wright Mills, the venerable sociologist,
yeah,
writing in the 1950s that there is no adequate study or appreciation in the American middle class of the meanings of work. What's been done since C. Wright Mills to answer that question?
The sociology of work is really interesting because there's two main points that come up over and over again when people ask people about their jobs, how they feel about their jobs, how they feel about their boss. You get pretty much uniform responses across almost all social classes, regions, ethnic groups. It's always the same. And that is, number one, people really do identify with their work. You know, if you ask somebody what they do, they assume you mean for a living, right? So people really feel that their job is how they get a lot of the meaning from their life. But the other thing they discover over and over again is that most people hate their jobs, which is very weird, right? So you know, this is the thing that I do in the world. This is what gives me meaning. It's horrible. How do you reconcile that? And basically, the sociology of work is trying to figure out how both of these things can be true at the same time.
This might be the crux of the matter. I wish you'd just set it out. The disbelief in work and the incredible overvaluing of work in tension in your brain and mind, certainly in the American middle class.
It is definitely a conundrum. But one possible resolution of this conundrum, and this is what I suggest in the book, is that for a lot of people at least, the fact that people hate their jobs is what makes it valuable to them. That work has become this kind of badge of moral legitimacy. It's almost like having an address. You know, it's economic citizenship. You're not recognized as a real person unless you have a home address, in the same way you are not recognized as a legitimate economic actor unless you have a job. You're not a real person. You're not a real adult. That's why people who are unemployed, even if they're getting quite generous unemployment insurance, you know, will tend to be quite miserable. It's also, I think, why people with BS jobs are so miserable, because they feel like frauds. They should be doing something. But at the same time, there is a sense that, you know, if you enjoy your work, well, that's a little weird. I mean, I even get that. I have a job. Some aspects of it are horrible, but some aspects of it are wonderful or great. You know, I really enjoy doing it.
Research, and teaching, writing.
Research. Yeah, I love teaching. I love, like, learning new things. It's great. And because I enjoy it, I sometimes think to myself, wow, you know, I can't believe somebody pays me to do this. You almost feel like you're ripping somebody off if you actually enjoy your work, no matter what value it creates. Here I am writing books that people read. You know, I'm obviously doing something which society recognizes as useful and valuable. But the fact that I enjoy it makes me feel like almost like I'm getting away with something. And there's something profound there. Why is it we assume we shouldn't enjoy our work or we shouldn't get anything out of it? There's a sense that the suffering that work inflicts upon us is what makes it real. That's what work is. It's something you would rather not be doing.
Right.
Otherwise, it would just be play, you know? It would be fun. It would be what you do in your spare time. They wouldn't need to pay you for it. So there is that sense that anything you get out of a job, any sense of gratification, makes it less valuable. And that perhaps explains a little bit of why it is we think it's okay that people who do something useful are paid so much less than people who don't, people who do useless or even harmful things. You know, there is a maybe unconscious sense that, well, you know, you get the joy of knowing that you're actually teaching people. I actually saw an ad once in the New York City subway system that said, you know, no one ever called someone up 20 years later to thank them for being such a great tax advisor.
Restate the conundrum, but consider the, shall we say, neurotic effects. Work defined as something that you don't want to do, you don't like to do, under people that you don't like, and building, as you write, resentment, suspicion, hatred, that becomes the kind of glue of the whole society.
Yes. Well, part of this conundrum is the very fact that on the one hand, you feel that work should be suffering, but on the other hand, the fact that work is actually useless kind of can't help but drive you crazy. On the other hand, you know, you're in this terrible paradox because we're all taught that people want something for nothing. You should be happy. You know, everybody, well, what does economics teach us, right? Economics teaches us that people want to get the maximum reward for the least amount of effort. That's rationality. We calculate how to get the greatest profit off the least investment. And if that were the case, well, people who have BS jobs who are paid to do very little or nothing would be delighted. You know, they win. Ha ha, I'm getting something for nothing. But that's not the way they feel at all in almost all cases. So there's this terrible paradox. So secretly, they actually, I'm convinced of this, they actually resent people who get to do real jobs. Because think about it. Why is it that people resent teachers so much? There's all these political campaigns against teachers. Or when teachers strike and demand more money, there's a sense of like, you're supposed to be altruistic. Why are you demanding more money? You know, you're supposed to be like public-spirited. Like, we all need to sacrifice. You should do the sacrifice. You're the kind of person who does that kind of sacrificial thing. I'm not. Or even people who make cars. After 2008, when there was an economic crash, right, it was caused by the banking system. It's not like any bankers were forced to take massive pay cuts afterwards. And when the auto industry almost crashed as a result of what the bankers did, and because the guys running the auto industry had made stupid investments, well, it's not as if the auto industry executives who made the stupid investments had to take any major sacrifices or pay cuts. Who had to make sacrifices and pay cuts? The auto workers, the guys who are actually making the cars. Well, they hadn't caused the problem, but there was a sense that, like, well, you get to make cars. That's like a real job. It's almost as if all these people with nonsense jobs are resenting people who actually get the gratification of knowing they're doing something that is actually benefiting society. We're America. We're all about cars. Everybody wants a car. You're providing us with cars. You're obviously providing a social benefit. Well, you also want to have a middle-class income and, like, take your kids on a vacation to see the Colosseum or the Grand Canyon. Like, that's not fair. You know, I have a BS job. I deserve something to compensate for the complete emptiness of my existence, but you get to make cars.
Coming up, the workaholics fess up, turning a day at the beach or the ballpark into work and other pathologies. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, David Graeber, is trying to warn us or wean us off the bullshit jobs he spent a lot of effort writing about. It isn't easy. Monday, Tuesday night, I gotta go to work. David, your argument is that we way overrate work. And we understand how many mechanical and now digital means there are to get the damn work done anyway. I'm typical. I'm a full-time workaholic and active fantasist of leisure. I'd rather be reading Proust. I'd rather be playing the piano, but I don't. How do we address this in the society, even in us? I bet you work too hard, too.
Oh, God, it's ridiculous. I've been trying to, like, make myself learn a musical instrument and do some things for fun. But in a way, I take up things that almost resemble work, because work is what I'm used to. I'm a total workaholic. But as such, I can kind of understand the pathology, because I see it in myself.
And you organize your leisure in lessons, in exercises, in small progress. Yeah. I did it better this time, rather than just saying, I'm going to fall on the piano and love the sound I make.
I do a little of that guitar in my case. But nonetheless, it's true that I end up allowing work to invade every aspect of my life. And I really literally wake up in the morning and say, oh, I have to write a book. I have to write a book. I have to get to work. I have to get to work. It's a pathology. I know it is, but I can't help myself. And the question is, how did we get that way? You know, how did we get to a point where we can't just kick back and enjoy ourselves? And insofar as we do enjoy ourselves, it's in these kind of little furtive ways. We have these, I call it compensatory consumerism. You know, we've invented things you can do in small packages of time, the length of a TV episode, or, you know, because those are the amounts of time that we actually have, you know, to go shopping for perfume or to watch Game of Thrones or to, you know,
binge on Babylon Berlin would just be overdoing it, right? You'd feel guilty.
Exactly. Or to just sit around in a cafe for 5 hours discussing somebody your friend's personal problems. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what real people do in real societies. I'm an anthropologist, right? And the thing that amazes me is that not only do we dedicate our lives to work because we can't imagine what else we would do of ourselves, but, you know, we're afraid of freedom. People have said things to me like, well, you know, if we gave people all this leisure,
leisure time, there would be a rise of drug addiction and crime, and people would do terrible things. It's like, I suppose if we lock everybody in prison for 12 hours a day, crime would go down too, but is that what we really want to do? It's a fear of freedom. That's what it is.
Now, that's really interesting. Fear of freedom even more than fear of the mob.
Exactly. It's fear of freedom. We don't know what we do of ourselves. And we're afraid not only of what we do of ourselves, but even more of what our neighbors would do to us. You know, it's like when people say, oh, well, we couldn't get rid of the police because everyone would start killing each other. You say, really? Would you start killing people if the police disappeared? Well, you know, I wouldn't, but other people would. And everybody's saying that. You know, everybody thinks that nobody else would know what to do with themselves if they had free time. Or nobody else would do something useful with themselves if they had the freedom to decide for themselves how they wanted to contribute to the world rather than having the employment market decide for them. And I'm convinced that's not the case. Yeah.
Now, this sounds like the real thing to me. You're talking about a conundrum. You're also talking about paradoxes, but also a kind of neurotic attachment to this work thing. I think as much as anything, Donald Trump got elected to be the greatest jobs president that had ever been. And all this trade war stuff is built around a notion that we can get those jobs back. We can manufacture all kinds of difficult things in this country again, and that's good. Deal with the illusions in those promises.
Well, the obvious illusion is technological. I mean, we're just not going to need as many people. And the system we have, it's not like they're going to hire people they don't need in blue-collar work. They'll hire people they don't need in white-collar work. But the entire trend of capitalism has been to apply ruthless efficiency to production. People with real jobs, they get downsized, they get sped up, they get tailorized and turned into effectively into machines, and they get replaced with machines. So manufacturing in this country, the numbers of people involved in manufacturing have just gone way down as productivity has gone way up. But at the same time, productivity in health, in education, in anything which involves working on other people, what I call caring labor, productivity there has gone way down because those areas have been infused with BS. People have to spend more and more of their time doing stupid stuff, and they've created stupid jobs that don't really need to exist. In fact, the two phenomena are related because, say, at a university, they hire administrators they don't need. What are those administrators going to do? They're going to make up stuff for me, the teacher, to do. That isn't my real job. So I'll have to do time allocation surveys and forms all day long. So as a result, education, health, all those caregiving or social service type occupations become less efficient and they become inflated. The cost of healthcare, of education goes way up. So there's a shift of jobs away from manufacturing toward these either pointless jobs, which are just effectively made up to keep people working, or jobs which are real, which are made much more difficult and less efficient because of the dead weight of all those administrators placed on top of you. So essentially, we're just making up jobs to keep us working. We don't need any of this.
I've been reading E.P. Thompson. It seems to me in the 18th century, Thomas Paine especially, people addressed the reality here more to the point. Pamphlet. In the early 19th century, workers' pamphlet. We toil and you enjoy. We produce and you dissipate. Wealth flows from us and you absorb it. Like, this BS has got to stop. Do we hear that anywhere in our overworked, tortured population today?
Well, there was a huge campaign against that sort of thing. Yeah, it's really interesting. If you listen to the way people talked in the 19th century, well, you know, what's now referred to as the labor theory of value was pretty much universally accepted. I mean, even Abraham Lincoln, if you read his speeches, he sounds kind of like a Marxist. You know, he's constantly saying things like all capital is derived from labor. Labor is the source of all value. People would say that. Nobody says that nowadays. Back then, if you said wealth creator, people assume you meant workers. Nowadays, if you say wealth creator, people assume you mean rich people. Well, there's a reason for that. There was a reaction to just that kind of pamphlet, just that kind of language. People like Andrew Carnegie, a lot of what are now called the robber barons of that robber baron era where corporate capitalism, as we now know it, was created, were very self-conscious. We got to do something about this idea that labor produces all value, that productive labor is the font of what makes our lives possible, and that people get the meaning from their lives from their work and the productivity of their work. So he basically said, no, we need to send people out to schools, to rotary clubs. They did this. It was a whole campaign to create what he called the gospel of wealth. It's people like me who create wealth, he said.
Interesting. Makers and takers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you guys, you might as well be an extension of the machines. You're just like doing a mechanical job like a robot. However, that's okay because this will create a situation where you don't need to get the meaning from your life from what you produce. You can get the meaning of your life from what you consume. So when you go home and, and consume the products, because our industrialization will make this very bounteous consumer society, that's where you can develop the meaning of your lives. So then the question remains, what inspires you to work at all other than sheer necessity? How can you have value in work if you're not producing wealth? And the answer to that is, well, work is suffering. You go back to this kind of theological idea that we're all cursed by God to work, but through doing so, we become a true adult, we become a better person. And people really feel that way. People really feel that anyone who isn't working harder than they would like to work at something they don't really enjoy is like a bad person. They don't deserve public relief. They don't deserve the love and support of their community.
There is the resentment, the suspicion, the oppression that you're writing. Interestingly, David, becomes the glue of a society. We're all unhappy together, being overworked by people we don't like at BS jobs. You say it becomes a sort of warfare, social warfare, but also a kind of spiritual violence to us and our country.
It's remarkable the damage that it does. And I think this is a huge social problem that people simply haven't been talking about. And it's partly because of this morality of work. People really think work is good. How can too much work be a bad thing? You would never imagine someone just writing a column saying, you know, everybody in America is just working too hard. We need to slow down a little bit and relax. Nobody ever says that. I mean, it's obviously true. If you want to save the environment, for example, probably the best thing we could do is work about half as much as we do now. That's true, right? It's this thing you can't say. And as a result, we can't talk about the effects, which are terrible. Look at rates of depression. I read somewhere that America is a country where 49% of the population will have some experience of clinical mental illness at some point in their lives, the overwhelming majority of which is clinical depression. Well, what is clinical depression? It's when you have no motivation, you can't bring yourself to care about anything. There's a complete collapse of energy because things seem meaningless and pointless, and what's the point of doing anything? That's exactly the feeling that you have when you have a BS job, because it's actually true if you have a BS job. In fact, what people are feeling is exactly what our work situation objectively creates as the living situation that people are in 8 hours a day for at least half the population. But as soon as everybody knows but can't say that their work is actually completely pointless and meaningless, suddenly everybody starts screaming at each other about deadlines. They get really tense. They become abusive. There's all this bullying. The entire tone changes. So people treat each other worse. And there's huge psychological damage from all this. People didn't used to just show up at jobs and start shooting people until the 1980s. That just never happened in America at all. And we have all these bizarre pathologies which seem to be related to work. And we can't talk about them. And we can't even speculate that maybe it has something to do with the fact that all of us know that we're not really doing anything and our work situation is oppressive and absurd.
And we still see robots coming to take the BS jobs away from us.
We're always told that, well, you know, market capitalism, it creates inequalities, it creates some things that seem like injustice, but we have to put up with it because it's efficient. It is the most efficient way to allocate resources to create a consumer society.
It's competitive, it's lean, it's mean, it's...
Yeah, and obviously if that were true, it's hard to imagine how it would create all these useless jobs. But let's talk about this robots rhetoric. It seems to me if there's ever a sign that we have an inefficient system, it's the fact that the possibility of automation replacing unpleasant jobs is seen to be a problem. Isn't that the thing that our ancestors were waiting for generations and generations? You know, someday our grandchildren will live in a world where they won't have to work hard because technology will make sure that there are robots to do all that stuff. So instead, right, we have this situation where we cannot possibly imagine how, under our existing economic system, we could do something so simple as allocate the necessary work evenly across the population and allocate the resources in such a way that, you know, everybody gets enough food and to meet their basic needs. Why should that be so difficult? Instead, it's like, oh no, robots are going to be a problem and nobody's going to have a job.
Okay, there's your assignment right there, David Graeber. Reallocate the work that has to be done and then reallocate the leisure, the fun, the pleasure, the discovery, the civilization that people have barely glimpsed.
And this is important because, you know, I'm an anthropologist and when people say, what would people do with themselves if we give people a three-hour day? Like, they're just going to sit around doing nothing, you know? They'll be depressed and watch TV. Well, the only reason we think that is the case is because we have so little time, we've forgotten what it's like to have a life. We know that there are plenty of societies where people work 2 or 3 hours a day. Even the average medieval serf, if you average out how much they worked over the course of the year, they probably put in a five-hour day, you know, on average.
What were they doing after the plowing?
Oh, you know, they hung around, they sang songs, they played games, you know, they gossiped. They traveled, they took walks, they went to fairs. If you look at medieval festivals, right, after the plague wiped out about a third of the population, wages, as you might imagine, went way up because there was a labor shortage. So there's a lot of resources reallocated to ordinary people in that period. And that's the period we have this sort of efflorescence of popular festivals. Every other day was a holiday and they did crazy stuff. You know, on this day, we'll build giant wicker dragons and set them on fire. On this day, women will form marauding bands that are allowed to kidnap men on the road and hold them hostage. On this day, we'll take the children and make them mayor. You know, they would do all sorts of crazy stuff. They had fun.
Stick with it. Reallocate your time and mine to the piano, to fun, to festivals.
Yeah. And a lot of what people do is they have complex social lives. We forget about this. And in fact, I'm convinced that, you know, one reason for the rise of social media, instead of having real social lives, we have these sort of strangely mediated social lives, is exactly because more and more of our time is filled with work, but during a lot of that work, we're not actually doing anything. Back in the 60s, for example, if you look at popular cultural forms that emerged in the 50s and 60s, there was beat poetry. It just goes on forever. The half-hour drum solo, LSD. Trips take a long time. You know, that's the thing about drugs. They last for a long time. So there's all this stuff that assumed a society of leisure where people had time on their hands. Now what do we got? We got YouTube rants. We got cat memes. We got Instagram, Twitter. All of this stuff is stuff that you can do while you're pretending to do something else. So our popular cultural forms are all things you can do while you're pretending to be working.
A lot of people who listen to you and me right this minute, David, are pretending to work.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Podcasts? Come on.
For people who demand a remedy for every problem, what's the Graeber remedy?
At the moment, I'm thinking that universal basic income might be the way to go. We could try to massively reduce working hours, but the problem is how would you actually do that? And how would you have to do that without creating a huge new government bureaucracy to measure how much people are working, to monitor, to enforce, which itself will create new BS jobs, because any huge government project always will. Same with the job guarantee program. I think that'll create a lot of BS jobs. So my preferred solution is to simply detach work from compensation. I know it sounds crazy, but a moral case could be made if we have a society where there's an inverse relationship between how much your work helps others and how much you're paid. You know, just giving everybody a flat fee just to exist and saying, look, I know, let's institute economic freedom. Let's everybody just go off and decide for themselves how they want to contribute to society individually or collectively. You know, they can get together with others. And the idea that people under that circumstance wouldn't work is clearly not the case, because if people were really lazy and if they got a handout would just sit there and do nothing, well, then people who have BS jobs wouldn't be so miserable, right? I mean, because they basically are getting something for nothing and they're deeply unhappy. I always talk about prisons, right? Like, look at prisons. Even in those minimal security prisons, if they want to punish people, they take their work privileges away. People would actually rather be pressing shorts in a prison laundry than sitting there watching TV all day. They go crazy doing nothing. The other thing people say is, well, you say, it's up to you how you want to contribute to society. Well, a lot of people will do useful things, but a lot of people will do stupid things. You know, there'll be hordes of bad poets and crank scientists and annoying street musicians and so forth. Well, yeah, okay, sure, there will be. But how can there be 40%? If 35 to 40% of the population are already engaged in useless activities, it's really hard to imagine that the situation would be any worse than it already is. And anyway, those people will be a lot happier. At least they'll be doing stupid things that they like. That'll help society. And, all right, maybe most of them will be useless, but you never know. Like, if one of those crank scientists ends up developing a teleportation device, or one of those annoying musicians turns out to be John Lennon, well, you know, you just made your money back, because that's infinitely valuable.
What working class hero is something to be.
The English humor guy of the last century, Jerome K. Jerome, spoke for most of the people I know. He wrote, I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. I love to keep it by me. The idea of getting rid of it nearly breaks my heart. Thanks to listeners first and last for putting up with ours. Thank you, David Graeber. His book, as you've gathered, is Bullshit Jobs, A Theory.
Working class hero is something to be.
Our show this week was produced by hardworking people Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Donay, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. There are no BS jobs at Open Source. Mary McGrath sees to that. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.